Hey guys, did you know that I have a book called Life of the Party? You can get it at bookstores, or you can get it at BertBertBert.com, where you can also find my tour dates. I'm on tour. Hey, rate, review, subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. Today's guest, one of my favorite co-hosts of one of my favorite talk shows ever, Loveline, Mike Catherwood.
This is
It's mostly for me. It's double flights.
Oh yeah,
like if I fly to
stop somewhere.
Yeah. If I have to stop somewhere, I have a hard time. I have a hard time just taking a Xanax and then taking another one, and then I'm just let's call a spade a spade. I like to drink.
Yeah.
So I like to tap out emotionally, and fucking. And be the artist, be the like rock star that I
tortured
was kind of
guy, yeah,
yeah, the tortured guy.
Shit's more fun that way too. I mean, that's it. Wouldn't be a like the downside's too big for that not to be true. Like when you're drunk, mundane shit is fun.
Yeah,
you know, that's the bottom line. Like sitting watching a shitty B-rate movie on a plane with a bunch of strangers is not at all enjoyable, but if you get like four cocktails in, it can be great. You know?
It can actually take it to the next level. Yeah. I mean, if you watch Lone Survivor drunk, that first 5 minutes you'll want to join the fucking Marine Corps.
Yeah,
like you'll be a Navy SEAL.
Yeah,
in a heart. It's one of the
you're
most
like doing
inspiring
push-ups and stuff.
Yeah, I'm like, I got to change my fucking life. I need brothers in my life. I need fucking guys that will go to war for me. But so that's where my head's at. I don't need to really introduce you. I'm sure if you read this is what I hate. People are like, you didn't introduce him until 5 minutes in. Well, you read the fucking lead into the podcast. That's why you're here.
Yeah.
It's Mike Catherwood, everybody.
How are you?
I'm doing good, man.
It's good to see you, Mr. Kreischer.
I got to be really honest. I absolutely loved your Alison Rosen podcast.
Oh, really?
It's such a different side of you than what I know to be on Loveline.
Well, thank you.
Loveline's a very powerful side of you.
Well, and also, you got to – it's hard. I mean, I'm sure you deal with it every day as a stand-up. You want to try to deliver authenticity, but you're an entertainer. I mean, that's what you're paid to do.
I'm having a hard time with authenticity and entertainment right now because of what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, you feel a certain responsibility to give the audience what they want, and that's not necessarily always the real, quote-unquote, the real you, because it's just like with reality TV. I mean, if they were to really just put cameras on walls and let people film people's lives, 90% of it would be so boring. I mean, aggressively boring.
That's what I thought reality TV was.
You have to highlight kind of the fun stuff.
That's why I liked reality TV. I thought that's what it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the first real reality television show was Stern's show on E! Because that was really just kind of filming people reacting to extreme stuff.
It's like very insightful. I've never really looked at it that way.
You'd see like fist fights and people, you know, having complete mental breakdowns and you know, crying and all these real reactions that no one going into work intended to kind of do, you know, and then next, you know, boom, it pop off like that. So
what was which is interesting because you got your start with Kevin and Bean, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I learned that on Allison's podcast, and I also didn't know Ralph Garman was on that show.
Yeah.
I know Ralph Garman from Twitter.
Really?
Like, I don't know him. I only know him from Twitter, but I didn't, and I don't really know how I know him. Like, wasn't he, what else did he do?
Joe Schmo was his, I think
that's
his big,
it. Yep.
Big
Joe
kind
Schmo.
Of.
My buddy produces Joe Schmo.
Yeah.
And so that's how I knew Ralph Garman.
That's an excellent TV show.
It really is.
And it was so ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ralph was the smarmy host of Joe Schmo.
What's Kevin, this is going to sound very weird.
Yeah.
I've never listened to Kevin and Bean.
Yeah, I mean, people have their like,
well, I just think I just got to L.A.
Yeah.
later than when you would have found that show.
Sure.
Like, I think
well, also, I think morning radio is a lot like your morning news show. Like, if you're a Today Show guy, you just watch the Today Show. You don't even explore the idea of, like, watching, you know, the CBS show. And I think morning radio is, like, you have your thing. You don't really – if your favorite radio show is syndicated and it's on in that market, you're not going to, like, explore other options. You have your people, you know?
Yeah, I was an XM guy. Yep. I was an XM guy when I moved out here. XM was becoming popular, and ONA and Stern were both on XM. So I was like, so I got onto them. And the only time I ever really listened to, this is going to sound really fucking horrible, the only radio that I've ever listened to is Big Boy's Neighborhood, and
As far as like local LA guys?
Local LA.
Yeah.
Big Boy's Neighborhood. Is that it? Big Boy. Yeah. Am I thinking the right thing?
Yeah.
Big Boy's Neighborhood and the Steve Harvey Show.
Yeah.
That's so not my demographic, but I love Steve Harvey Show.
That's because, so your demographic, because you're urban black male.
Yeah, exactly.
You're in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Boy, you know, he's not only in like an LA radio legend. I mean, the guy's legit, you know.
Yeah.
He's been balling in LA for God, almost two decades. So.
So when you got to Kevin and Bean, were you sober?
Yeah.
Seriously, when did you get sober?
2002.
2002?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I first tried in 99.
I don't want to talk about sobriety, by the way, this whole time. I know we started talking about that, and I'm sure it's something everyone wants to talk to you about. But
yes and no. I mean, like, look, some people want to talk about it from the perspective of, like I'm some kind of weird circus freak, you know, like. Super bros are like, dude, how can you live your life without knocking back a six pack? And it's like,
yeah.
I certainly don't mind talking about it in any forum, but that can get annoying because it's like, I'm not straight edge. Like, I'd love to drink. I really would. I mean, my hat's off to people who can control it. I'm the worst. I'm the worst alcoholic there is, you know?
That's interesting when you meet people who go, no, these are good decisions I'm making.
Yeah.
Like, there was a guy, general managers of the Denver Improv, or one of the managers of the Denver Improv, picked me up for radio, and then we went to, we were in Denver. Mm-hmm. So we went to, I wanted to see what the smokehouses are.
From what I hear, that's like one of the best burgeoning comic towns. Like, Denver's like, the whole community is like, they're really supportive of themselves. They have a lot of good clubs, the whole deal.
Yeah, it's a great town, I think. I love Denver. I love Denver personally. And so we went to the smokehouse, and I was like, are you going to get any weed? And he's like, oh, I'm sober. Yeah. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. And he just was definitively like, he's like, oh, it's a good thing. And then he went through and told his stories and his bottom, and it was fucking fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so convinced like it's always a good thing. I just know without a question, without a shadow of a doubt, it's a really good thing for me.
Yeah.
without a shadow of a doubt.
Do you think you flipped it into working as hard as you do?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely very addictive in many other facets of my life now that I don't have drugs and alcohol, without question.
Really?
Yeah, I mean,
you jack off a lot?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I jack off
like a ton. Like, yeah. I actually think I have a problem with it.
I do too.
Yeah.
Because I used to jack off because I was horny and I didn't have someone to have sex with. Now I'm jacking off almost as a means to like curb some weird, almost deviant appetite. You know, like I'm not beating off for sexual pleasure anymore. I'm almost beating off to like, to tame the beast within.
Yeah,
you know?
I witnessed myself go through that today.
Yeah,
I was like, this is fucking ridiculous. But what happened to me is like, I'm the only one home. My family is in Alabama.
Yeah,
so I'm the only one in LA, and I was like, I never get this kind of freedom where I can just jack off in my house.
Yeah,
like this is insane. And then I end up in the bed by myself, going, what am I fucking doing?
Yeah.
You know, wearing my wife's
with the rubber ball gag in my mouth. It's weird because I really feel, and I know some people who are sex addicts, like legitimate sex addicts, and it's crazy because like every guy who gets caught cheating on his wife, that's the new excuse to go to. But I mean, I know guys who make their dick bleed because they jack off so much. They're so addicted to sex that, you know, really good, solid human beings, high school teachers, like solid dudes that they can't go a day without buying a hooker because they just need someone new to have sex with. And so I know guys like that. And it's so easy nowadays to kind of fall into that trap because porn and like the whole sex trade is just so goddamn good now.
Oh, think about when it was from, I don't know how old you are, but I know you're
35.
Younger than me. Yeah. You're like 6 years younger than me. Think about where it was when I was a kid. My first porn was, I found like a Hustler magazine in the woods.
It's horrible.
But I was like, this is the best thing I've ever found in my entire life. I cleaned that magazine so that I could use it. And I had that magazine. I didn't get my first pornography tape, personal porn tape, that I had that I could use at my leisure until I was 26.
Yeah, I was a little younger than that, but I was already working at K-Rock, and I would just get them for free. Like Vivid and all the, you know, those big companies in the early 2000s, that was still a viable thing, like DVDs.
Yeah,
so they'd send over like, you know, their new movies. I just take them home. Just.
When I moved to LA, I got a show on the X. I got a show on FX on the, it's called The X Show, and I got, they would give us porns, and I was like, I remember like my heart racing, being like, this is going to be fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But then, and then now it's like porn is so, I mean, I look at the page of you porn and I just look at thumbnails and I'm like, ugh.
If I was 14, like when you really get like sex crazed as a boy, if I had access to like RedTube and YouPorn and stuff, I don't know what I'd do. And I think that's why so many kids, boys nowadays, straight males, and you know, when they get to be like 18, 20, they're different now. They're not as all wrapped up. Like, I was obsessive about getting pussy.
Yeah.
I mean, I really was. Like, it was all I could think about. I would forego anything to get laid. And I just don't see that in young males nowadays because they, it's like, well, I've been watching Double Anal since I was 13.
Yeah.
Do I really need to kind of go after this thing that's been very diluted?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you think it changes their perspective of what they want to, how they'll derive pleasure out of sex?
I think so. Because
remember the first time you got a chick
that
you could do everything with?
Yeah.
No, except fucking the ass.
Yeah.
But like,
no, the first chick I could do anything with was, like, I think that I was really thrown for a loop by my high school girlfriend. Like she was fair game for anything. Like, I was eating ass and doing anal when I was, like, 16.
Really?
Yeah. Not because I'm
eating ass at 16.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And not because I'm such a stud or anything, but because, like, she was so,
she was a baller.
Open. Yeah.
She's like, I fucking go hard in the paint. Let's make this happen.
And I don't know if she knew any better. She was not a citizen of this country.
Oh, so, my God. Like, Tell me more about this story.
Yeah.
What is she, Russian?
No, she was Mexican.
Oh.
I mean, I grew up here in LA, so it was like, but she wasn't like I know everybody's thinking she wasn't a citizen and in LA and a Mexican. She wasn't like an illegal. She worked for her mother was a dignitary for the Mexican consulate.
Oh, this chick.
I know.
Can you describe her? Who does she look like? Like Selma Hayek or like,
no,
or
no, like more Art like, but she was cutesy more so than like bombshell. She was like she looked like a more of a Mexican, like a Neve Campbell. Like a young, you know, but like high school age.
I love
Neve
Campbell.
Yeah.
I think Neve Campbell's so fucking hot. So was it you doing the research and then bringing it back to her? Or was her like let's try this? Or you just.
It was definitely I was the one who was really like imposing these new ideas.
Hey, I read a book.
Yeah, and I wasn't. And I, even looking back on it, to be honest, I wasn't like a creep about it. I wasn't like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You smeedle. I mean, it was just like. I was so horny all the time. I was so upset. And she, look, I had a girl who would let me have sex with her pretty much whenever we were alone. And I was 16. And like, that was a gold mine. And then so once I realized like, okay, like this will work. She's open to this. Why don't we give this a shot? And she would more often than not say yes. So
really?
Yeah.
So then the next chick you fuck.
Then the next, like when I got to be, I don't know. 19 and really like exploring the world sexually for the first time, like really let loose on the world. I was living in, I moved up to San Francisco and I met some girls who were just weren't that way, you know, and I really felt like a disgusting pervert.
Oh, you know? So you bring in what you know to be how you dance by yourself in the dark.
Yeah.
And then they go, I'm sorry, I only foxtrot.
Yeah.
And you're like, ooh, this is awkward.
I don't understand. I mean, I thought like, I really had this inner conflict of, am I insane and was I devoting my entire sexual adolescence to another person who was utterly insane, or are these girls just totally milktoast?
Oh,
and then
from
18 to 21, that's when I battled that, and then I just came to the conclusion I was nuts. And you know, once by the time I was 21, I'd already gone to rehab and failed, moved to New York City. I was smoking speedballs and stuff like all day, not eating. So by that point, I had thrown caution to the wind. It's like, I don't really care what anybody thinks.
Yeah.
If someone will let me have sex with them, I'm going to. Whether it's bland or it's double fisting, I'm doing it. You know, so.
That's crazy. Now, how adventurous are you on the flips? Like, have you ever let a girl put her finger in your ass?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Me too.
I'm pretty open-minded. Like, I mean, I'm pretty open to anything my wife would want to do.
Yeah.
As long as it's like I wouldn't. I would say I wouldn't harm myself, but I totally would. I wouldn't. I don't think I'd go. I don't think I'd go uber gay.
Yeah. I don't think I'd.
I don't think I'd even do any gay to please her. I'd do it to get a laugh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll go gay to get a laugh in a heartbeat. I think gay. I think I could have so much fun if I was gay.
Yeah.
Like, I think I would really enjoy a gay lifestyle if I could just get past the part of kissing dudes.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only part of the, like, but just hanging out with guys and then nothing's off limits.
No, I went surfing probably 6 months ago with, like, my close buddies, and we, it was football season, and one of the guys was from, he's born and raised in Georgia, and we would, like, went surfing in the morning, and we went back to my place in Venice, and we barbecued, and he's like, we got to watch the Georgia game. And I was like, yeah. And then we were just all hanging out at my place and looking around. I'm like, in between, at halftime, we were like playing Xbox. And I was like, if I could just fuck these guys, like, life would be so awesome. Like, life would be so amazing. And, but yeah, I'm just, I don't have it. And I don't have that kind of desire.
Did you grow up with like I go back to, I'm a little obsessed right now with growth, like personal growth. Cultural growth and men,
sure,
white men who are going through that. You're Mexican,
yeah,
but I mean,
but I'm half and half. Yeah, my dad's like,
you're like my buddy Eddie Fernandez is full Mexican. I still call him a white guy.
Yeah, my dad's as like he is white. He's an Irish immigrant. Parents lived in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. He's like white. Yeah.
But I always go through with this like what we now know to like cultural growth, like. Like I don't say, and I get a lot of shit for this. I said this on somewhere, like I obviously don't use the N word,
yeah.
But like I then said, well, if the M word is offensive and the F word is offensive, well, let me just pull them all out of my thing, and then I start thinking, like I start looking at like where we're going, and I start like anytime someone brings up a debate, I just go, well, what's the, I try to look at it like, what side of history am I on? Like, I don't, like, you know, there were people that really didn't like Martin Luther King.
Yeah, like, exactly.
They were like,
no, for sure. You bring up a good point. I mean, in 30 years, maybe shorter, maybe longer, but around there, there's going to be people looking at 2010 to 2016. Like, people really were adamant about gay guys not getting married. Like, gays and lesbians couldn't get married. That's insane.
Yeah.
You know, like, we watch, you know, 42 and see Jackie Robinson not being able to get on the same bus, and we're like, that's fucking insane. I can't even wrap my head around
Why
it.
Why didn't he say something?
Yeah.
Clearly, they've not, like, I mean, and I always say, and I hope this comes off as sensitive as I mean it, but, like, what we now know as black people, like, the people I know, my black friends, would never have stood for getting not told to get on the bus.
Yeah,
that is the one,
sure,
culturally, they are the most... the proudest, and it's like you look back and you're like, how fucking different of a time was that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because every black acquaintance you and I have ever had didn't grow up in an era where they were so outnumbered socially.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still outnumbered by numbers in this country. But I mean, like, you couldn't say something because every dude in the diner or the bar or the bus or wherever it was would gang beat you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, so we don't, like, we can't even, I mean, I truly can't wrap my head around it. We had a guest on Loveline. His name's Charles Connor, and he's actually like one of the daytime security guys at K-Rock at the radio station I work at.
I think okay, yeah.
And but he, before he retired from music, was Little Richard's drummer for like 50 years, and
really?
He started with him in Macon, Georgia in the 40s. I mean, he has this unbelievable story of music and like the backbone of American rock and roll and R&B. And he was telling us these stories about life and growing up and being around Little Richard and James Brown in the early days. And he got to talking about his first, like, real serious girlfriend, and she was white. And he was with her for 13 years, and they couldn't get married because they were living in the South. And, like, Drew and I were, you know, we're looking at each other. We're just like, I just can't even really put my mind – like, I can't understand. Like, he loved this girl. They were together for 13 years, and they just – never could get married, you know. It wasn't an option.
It's just so insane to think of that now and go, oh yeah, that's just. And I mean did your dad get shit when he started dating a Mexican chick?
I think so.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. But yeah,
that's gotta be like, that was like 75.
Yeah, when my mom and dad met, and you know, in the mid 70s in LA, it was probably pretty cool, because I'm sure that was the era of like, whatever, man.
Yeah,
whatever goes, you know. And my dad, oddly enough, who never met anybody of any ethnicity until the Vietnam War.
Really? Your dad was in the Vietnam War?
Yeah. Is
he still alive?
Yeah. And but my dad, you know, he worked for – he went in as an officer, and he worked for – because my dad's pretty old for to have a kid my age. He's 71, so he went in as an officer, and so he didn't have to, like, you know, see the shit. He was, but he worked at the Pentagon and at NORAD. He was, and my dad's a pretty erudite guy. And so he was working at the Pentagon.
I have to stop you. I don't know what erudite means.
He's a sharp dude. He's a right brain
guy. I'm sorry. I'm past the time of going, okay, yeah, because then I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm sorry.
Right, whatever it means. He's a digits and science guy.
Okay.
He's very, very sharp.
Did you go to college?
No.
Keep going.
Yeah.
You're really smart.
Thank you.
For not going to college.
I mean,
not that I did anything with my college experience.
But I'm
experience.
Not. I mean, I guess I read a lot. I like information, and I feel like people tell me I'm well spoken and I'm well informed on stuff. But when it comes to being smart, like when I talk to Dr. Drew about, like, knowing shit,
yeah,
I'm really not smart. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Like, my light bulb went out the other day, and I was replacing it. And I was like, if I had to figure out how this worked, I'd be fucked. I mean, I might as well be figuring out a nuclear submarine.
I went to change a light bulb the other day, and I was like, where are the light bulbs? My wife's like, oh, you need to go buy some. And I'm like, wait, what wattage do I get? I don't know anything about wattage or why there's different watts or what soft versus – I don't know anything about fucking light bulbs.
So when it really comes to smart, like putting rubber to the road, like the guy who came over, our electrician eventually came over like 3 weeks ago, and I'm like, you're so much smarter than me. Like,
yeah,
you have so much more applicable knowledge than me because I use the word erudite.
Like,
you know,
what do you do in – like, I often ask myself this. What do I do in an apocalypse? Am I really standing by the campfire just hosting the apocalypse?
No.
Like, just cracking jokes? I can't fucking... All right, everybody. Farmers, you go build some things. Cops, you build the shrimp perimeter. Bert?
The comedian is... honestly, and I'm not just saying this to kiss ass. If you really step back and analyze what humanity has done, the person who devotes his or her life to creating joy for others is the most beautiful thing in the world. But if you analyze it from a strictly animal aspect, the most useless thing in the world. You know what I'm saying? Like the comedian or the comedy writer or the satirist is the most beautiful thing that's ever been developed by humankind, because it's someone who devotes their life to bringing joy to others.
Yeah.
And think about, like, really what it means to make other people laugh, like a belly laugh. It's so beautiful. It's more beautiful than anything ever. But if you think about when, like you said, the shit goes down, well, what does that do for me?
Yeah.
Are you really going to hunt a fox and fucking skin that thing and make some steaks out of it?
I can't do a fucking thing with that.
I can't either.
I can maybe, if you give me the carcass, I can do a puppet show.
I skin and gutted a pig once.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm glad I did it, but like I just realized, like, this is not me.
Where did you do that?
In Italy.
How did you get there?
My dad's best friend is an Italian national. So, like, every summer he'd be like – he's an Italian citizen.
Oh.
So he lives here, but he's like a legit Italian citizen. And so he would always be like, you should come visit us every summer. Come to Italy. And we're like, okay. So we just go and hang out in Italy for, you know, summers, a couple summers when I was like junior high age.
Really?
Yeah. And one dude – I mean, we're not talking like Rome and Florence. This is out in the cut.
Yeah.
And so dudes would bring people – like, he'd bring you, like, a pig, like, as a gift.
Really?
Like, look at this pig I got you. And then, you know, everybody looks at me because at the time I was, like, you know, 13, 14. And like, go take care of this. And I was like – I'd look at my dad. I'd be like, I don't – you know. And he's like, don't worry. And so, like, we'd get someone to – and they're like, you got to do this, though. I mean, you're a young man. You have to –
This is part of the initiation.
Yeah, this is part of the deal. And so I was like, okay. And I wasn't a fan of it, but I'm glad I got to, like, see how it goes down and how it goes from living, breathing creature to the pork you're eating later that night.
Everyone should harvest their own meat at some point.
Yeah.
Just so you can put a perspective on it. You go, okay, that's where I got this.
Sure.
Because if you don't, then in a weird way, you just wolf down burgers and you're like, fucking whatever. It's like, own the shit you do. Rogan's a big proponent of harvesting his own meat.
Yeah. He makes a lot of sense, too. Because I'm not one of those guys who thinks, like, either you have to be vegan or you have to hunt your own food. That's like saying if you want to listen to the radio, you have to do your own show.
Right.
It's insane. There's people who are hunters and farmers, and they make food. There's people who live in cities and are consumers, and you eat food. That's how it works. I don't think you have to, like – but I do feel like we should make a movement to get away from these, like, massive farms, like factory farms. I don't feel like – like, if aliens analyzed our whole, like, system of Earth from afar, they'd be like, wait a second, this doesn't work, this doesn't add up. Like, they just put them in cages, like thousands and thousands of them, And they don't get a chance to live a life or breathe, and then they just slaughter them. And
maybe they'd be skinnier if they tried to chase them down.
Yeah, like that doesn't make much sense to me. But how we get on to?
I have no fucking idea. Oh, you, when you became a man?
Yeah, when I just
do you think? Do you think that what at what? At, like I'm trying to think of the moment I was like, all right, I'm officially a man. I think it was very recent.
Yeah, I don't think I was probably like in my late 20s, maybe early 30s.
Where you were like
a lot of people are like, oh, I was 14 when I I was.
I've been a little boy my entire life. I've always been my father's son.
Yeah.
I will always continue to be my father's son until he's dead, and then I'll probably be a man.
I don't feel like I've constantly lived in the shadow of my parents, but I don't feel like I'm a real, like I, you know, I felt like I was a provider and like a solid man until pretty recently.
So I have to implore everyone to go listen to Allison Rosen's podcast with you because it's so fucking good.
Oh, thank you, dude.
But it was fascinating. I knew you were married. I knew you were married to a really hot chick.
Yeah, yeah.
She was in
Rules of Engagement.
Rules of Engagement.
She's on Undateable now on NBC.
Oh yeah, with
Chris D'Elia and Brent Moore. A lot of funny comics
and Ron Funches.
Ron Funches, man. He's a home run hitter.
He's great. We went back and forth about doing the podcast. He's an interesting guy. We both have ridiculous laughs.
Yeah, very interesting dude. Like really, what he comes off as kind of like life of the party giggly dude.
Yeah.
But you get to start talking to Ron. He's very, very interesting. Very thoughtful.
Now, I don't want to rehash anything you guys talked about, but your breakup with your first wife, is pretty fucking epic.
It was pretty brutal for me, you know, and it wasn't one of these like she's cheating on me and I walked in on him. But it was just she kind of got bored with me. Like she really.
Well, it's
not it's kind of. She did.
It's one of the It's one of the things. When I heard you talking about it, I was like, yeah, I can see how that happens. Like I can see how, especially at that age.
Yeah,
you know, like my 43. My wife's 43 now. She's a lot like, well, I don't want to do anything. But you know, you're living the life that is ideal. I mean, you're living a great life. You're on Kevin and Bean.
Yep.
You're doing Loveline. You're on E. You're on, and you've got this chick who's young, a little younger than you, but like 22 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you're sober, so you're not like, hey, let's stay out until fucking 4 a.m.
Right. I mean, I gotta get up at 4 a.m. to go to work. You know, to go to Kevin and Bean to be live at 5 a.m.
Now, all I could think the whole time was, where were you guys living at the time?
South Pasadena.
Really?
Yeah.
South Pas is great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in that neighborhood. That's kind of like my hometown.
Oh, yeah? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. So that's my wife at the time. Actually, she's from South Orange County, but she wanted to live there because it was close to my family. And she was close to where she worked. That's where I met her. I met her out like in Old Town Pasadena.
What'd she do?
She works at Katsuya, the one in Hollywood.
What's that?
Katsuya is a sushi
place. Oh, yeah, yeah. I've had
it's like real Katsuya. Trendy, hip. Yeah. Like a lot of celebs go there and stuff.
So, but... You go to Vegas.
Yeah. I went to one of the Kevin and Bean staff's surprise birthday parties.
And by the way, for the record, for those of you that don't know, Kevin and Bean is, I'll say arguably, but probably the biggest radio show nationally in the world right now.
No, I mean, because they've gotten back to doing just LA. But as far as like a market... Like Los Angeles, to be on the air for 21 years without beginning the boot or without and really consistently having great ratings through, you know, the Stern era and Mark and Brian and all these like legendary LA kind of radio personalities. Kevin and Bean are amazing. They are without question like one of the legends of syndicated talk morning radio.
Yeah, yeah. It is a huge show.
Yeah.
So you're working arguably for the Stern of the West Coast.
Sure, yeah. And at that time, you know, I when I started working with Kevin and Bean, Howard transferred over to Sirius maybe 3 or 4 years later. So it really was like I was part of this radio show. It would be like being on Stern's show in New York City in 1996.
And were
like,
you,
even if you were like a periphery member, you know, if you're Stuttering John or you're you know, KC Armstrong in the mid 90s, you're walking down the street in New York City. You're the man. You were still one of the men, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the way I kind of felt at times in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And you were one of the writers. You and Mark Ralph Garman were writing.
Ralph, yeah. Ralph really was like the big comedy guy and still is. But they hired me to do like just like low level production. And then as time went on, they really started incorporating me more
as a character in the show,
comedy.
Fucking stuff. Amazing that you can make it out of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 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 it does. But you know, the thing that separates Kevin and Bean, I think, from a lot of radio guys, is that they're really supportive about getting you to move on.
Really?
I mean, look, Carson Daly started there.
Carson Daly started there?
Adam Carolla started there.
Wait.
Jimmy Kimmel was their sports guy. You know?
Wait, are Kevin and Bean K-Rock?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yep.
So, I know nothing about West Coast LA. I think because I came to it late.
And what, look, like West Coast...
I knew K-Rock.
West Coast stuff, especially with media, is kind of like college football. It's like you have to really be there to know it. Like, no, you're not living in Atlanta or New York City hearing about USC football. You know what I'm saying? You're in SEC. You're listening to, you know, the Big Ten. That's what you get.
Yeah, and there's no real you can't really syndicate out to the East Coast because of times.
Exactly, but it's very easy to time delay Stern and so yeah. I mean, like Kevin and Bean and like K-Rock in and of itself is like this really strange yet unique and amazing place if you look at like all the things that have gone on there. But Kevin and Bean, they're not only okay with it, like they are pumped on the idea of you coming into their show and then finding other ways to build a career in entertainment.
They're
helpful. They give you insight, you know. They'll destroy you on the air.
Yeah.
But off the air, man, they are the best. It's supportive and Ralph's the same way, you know.
Yeah. And so then what was your next show after that?
Then I started doing TV work, just working with Kevin and Bean. I do like side TV work.
Yeah.
And then I got asked out of the blue to co-host Live with Regis and Kelly in 2009 or 10, something like that. They did this thing like where at the end of Regis's tenure there, he would start to get, you know, he would take time off because he was, you know, he's in his 80s or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So he'd take time out, and they do like the men of New York Fire Department, the men of Major League Baseball, the men, and each day during that 5-day week of shows, they would have a different guy of whatever kind of occupation.
Yeah.
So then they did like a men of radio week, and listeners had to nominate people to go in and co-host.
Really?
And listeners nominated me, and once I was on Live with Regis and Kelly, I'd done other TV stuff first. You know, I worked for E. Like I said, they used to do a show called The Daily 10, which was like E! News, but a little bit more.
Said you got it canceled. Why?
Essentially. Like, they were already wrapping it up, but I still, to this day, feel horrible, even though I don't at all feel bad about what I said. But I feel – because, like, so many good people worked on that show.
What happened? What did you say?
It was like they were pretty much considering winding down the show anyway, and they were signing the papers to cancel it, but they were still on the fence. And then I came in to co-host to fill in for Sal Masekela, who was the main host.
Yeah.
And there was a story about Adam Lambert. I don't know if you know who that is. He was on American Idol. He's a genius singer, beautiful voice. But he's like a really outspoken gay rights activist, and then also like proudly out of the closet gay guy himself. And there was a story about him being arrested for assault, and he might potentially see some jail time. And so off script, I go, from what I know of Adam Lambert, jail might not be all that bad.
Yeah.
And like the whole like kind of gay rights movement just came down on me with just a tidal wave of
negative
shit. And so.
So wait, and I know you battle a little bit with depression.
Yeah.
Do you fucking spiral?
Yeah, I did because I felt like.
And by the way, we all deal. I mean, like, everyone I know is. I didn't want to, like, I deal with OCD, depression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, we all deal with it.
I mean, I feel like, look, with my job hosting Loveline, I'm not a doctor, nor do I know anything about anything. So I feel like I'm almost obligated to be very open about all these problems I have because that's all I have to offer when I'm giving people advice is at least I have some kind of, like, anecdotal advice. So I'm very open about being heavily medicated, dealing with serious depression, alcoholism, the whole thing. So don't stress about like.
I believe that in out. The truth, and I believe the truth is the only way to speak.
Yeah.
If I tell the truth and it offends people, or if I tell the truth and it steps on what lies you built for yourself, I apologize.
Right.
I didn't mean to. You should maybe look at yourself and be a little more honest. That's why I look at my life, and I go, I can't help it, man. I can't keep up with your lies and his lies and his lies. And then what am I supposed to say again?
And even more so, I hate more so than like just the little white lies is the people who have. Especially people in the entertainment industry who have these like carefully constructed facades that you have to deal with. They come in for an interview and they're like, okay, you can't talk about this, this, and this, but go ahead. Do the interview.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a second. That's the biggest thing in your life. How am I supposed to interview you and not talk, you know?
I believe that there's so many sociopathic narcissists in this business that you interact with and you experience life with, and when and then all of a sudden they're a totally different person.
Yeah.
And you're like, and you bring, like, I'll off mic, I'll walk you through a story that will blow your fucking mind. But I'm not gonna, I like, look, everyone lives in their lie, live in your lie. I don't give a fuck. So So, anyway, you spiral?
Yeah, I did, because not because I felt like all these people are saying negative things to me. It was because, like, I felt like a lot of people were offended by something that I didn't mean to really offend. Like, I'm not a guy who has anything against, in fact, quite the opposite. I'm so supportive of the idea of the advancement of the LGBT community. So for them to not, like, I was just so hurt that, like, they misconstrued me as being an enemy. I'm not, you know, and I was like, come on. I was just making a clean little joke.
So
if I was hanging out with Adam Lambert at a bar or something, and I said that to him, he'd laugh. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's the guy who's out there holding the flag for the movement and advancement. Like, if we don't have humor, then where are we at?
It is. I do believe it should be directly reflected on your intention.
Yeah.
It's like when the Jonah Hill shit went down. Well, two things happened that I kind of noticed. I was like, well, number one, you're talking about a guy who's insulated in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And it's not – I mean, Jonah, I doubt you're listening, but if you are, I apologize for what I'm about to say. He's not really a man. Like, he's not a man.
Right. And I'm sure he'd be the first to admit it. He's not like a guy out there, like, punching a clock to going to work every day. And,
or
you know,
punching people, or ever punched by somebody. So I would venture to say that him throwing around the F word is – I don't think he meant it. Like, the only reason I don't say that word, other than Todd Glass kind of opened my eyes to what that shame that might give to a child. I don't want to. But also, I know that if I say that to a man, that also might mean that we fight, because I'm not an insulated Hollywood guy.
Yeah.
I'm a regular guy. So if I yell, hey, you know, I better be ready to fight. And I don't like fighting, because I'm a man and I've grown up fighting. And that is not. That's not, and I've been in fist fights.
I'd hate to get into a fist. I really
would. I don't want to get in a fist fight at all.
I'd have no aspirations.
Beat up, and then someone has the video of you unconscious, and he's still stepping on you, and it's just depressing. And if you, if you've never been in a fight, don't. It's so depressing the next day. That is the hardest part about getting in a fight. That, and when you take a shower, and you're like, why does behind my ear hurt?
Yeah, getting in a fight, even if you win, sometimes, like, it's not good. It's not good unless you're like a sadist and you just love that shit.
Oh, there's no, no one wins in a fist fight. Yeah. No one ever wins in a fist fight. Yeah. But
it's amazing. Stop using drugs and alcohol. Not in fist fights anymore.
Yeah. Oh, let me tell you something.
Getting to them all the time.
If you're getting into fist fights, it's you.
Yeah.
If you've been in two fist fights within the last 5 years, it's you. You have a problem and you need to go check yourself. Yeah. I can tell you all my friends that don't get in fist fights, and then I can tell you the ones that do, and they have fucking rage issues.
Very rarely is there, like you have to, and I know people who have lived in that situation, and that's not something, like, the fist fight aspect of it is the least interesting. Like, because if you have to fist fight, someone's trying to rape your wife, or someone is mugging your grandma.
Or you're like,
you have to fist fight.
Three guys have approached you in an alley regarding your shoes.
Yeah.
And you're like,
you know, so the fact that you got in a fist fight is like the least interesting aspect of it.
Yeah.
You
know? It's interesting. So wait, so, but I.
And I love fighting in that. I mean, I'm avid into martial arts and MMA and stuff. Yeah. Jiu-jitsu is like my main. But I started.
Where do you train?
I started studying Muay Thai. That was the first thing I studied. But now I train jiu-jitsu at Crone Gracie's Academy in Culver City.
Shut up.
Yeah.
He's fascinating. He was on Rogan the other day. Did you listen to it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were like talking about it on preparing to go on the show. I was like, dude, you're going to be amazing. Talk about Hickson and everything. He's like, oh, yeah.
Did he?
And Hickson comes through all the time. I mean, it's so crazy. Hickson Gracie will come through the academy and train with people. I mean, for people who don't understand BJJ and MMA, this is no exaggeration. That's like Michael Jordan cruising down to like a junior college and just shooting hoops with people.
I doubt there's anyone listening to this not realizing the weight of Hickson Gracie. I mean, he doesn't roll really much anymore, does he?
He won't. Like, it's not like he's doing hard rounds with you, but he will. He'll totally throw. He'll come in looking beautiful, by the way, at age 60 or whatever he is. Yeah, big, thick neck and muscular. And he'll throw on a gi top and he'll be like, you know, you're doing this wrong. No, you're stupid. You grab his neck and he'll get down and like, and do it with you, like, you know. Like I said, he's not going hard with
hold
you.
Hold on one second. My dogs are losing their fucking mind, and I feel like someone broke into my house.
Yeah.
Give me one second, okay?
Hold on. Now she's 140
which is now my current, probably. Sorry about that, guys. I know everyone goes, God, Bert, how fucking rude. But
no, dogs are okay, everybody. Dogs are good.
Yeah, Kron is one. That was a really fascinating interview, and the whole Gracie family, I trained one day. I did an episode of Hurt Burt, which was a show I had on FX, where I fought four Gracies at once, but it was...
That's a good idea.
Oh. I got choked out. That was fucking terrifying. But that
I hate... I actually dislike getting choked out worse than getting knocked out.
You dislike...
I know that sounds crazy, but I don't really want to do either anymore.
Yeah.
But getting choked out's a really strange, not fun feeling.
It's terrifying.
Losing consciousness from losing blood to your brain... The reason is like when you get knocked out, it's blunt force trauma to your head, and you fall down, you wake up, and you're like, oh yeah, man, I got knocked out. It takes you a couple breaths, and like you get it. When you get choked out, at least for me, and I've talked about it with like Jason Ellis from Jason Ellis Show.
He's a fascinating dude.
Fascinating dude too.
I got his book right here.
Yeah,
and we just bought his book.
Him and I both agree. He's definitely got a lot more experience with getting knocked out than I do, but. When you get choked out, you have weird nightmares, like intense.
Oh, yes, you do.
Extreme nightmares, and then you feel, and then you wake up, and you don't know where you are, and that's so much more jarring than just bam, you're out. You know,
yeah. Getting choked out to me was one of the scariest things. I'm really fascinated. I watched Hickson's documentary.
Choke.
It's fucking...
If you've ever watched like Jiro Dreams of Sushi or any of these movies, whether or not you give an S about grappling or mixed martial arts...
Did you just go back into radio voice?
Yes.
Whether you give an S.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how I did that. And whether or not you care at all about mixed martial arts or Brazilian jiu-jitsu or any of that, watch a documentary called Choke. Because
fucking fascinating.
It's just great to know that there's literally samurai still in the world. Like people who every breath they take is committed to being this cold as ice, completely relentless samurai that still live by the code of Bushido.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Like,
oh, it's
Hickson's
amazing.
Awesome.
I watched The Smashing Machine. I watched that this weekend. I was just like, holy shit. Like that guy was a fucking... Mark Kerr was
a smashing machine. But it's so funny because that movie to me... became so much more about his struggles with his addiction and his feelings of inadequacy, much more so than about him fighting. And, yeah. I thought that was the beauty of that movie.
That was pretty. I ended up spending the whole night trying to research what happened to Kron's older brother because he passed in New York, I guess, and they thought it was maybe a murder.
There's a lot of things that go on with big. Japanese MMA, like that's like kind of sketchy, like fixed fights or like the Yakuza getting involved, and
was Pride, right?
Yeah, you know, like the Pride in the early stuff, but like even before that, they had other, I forgot, not Glory, but they had like
I listened to
K1 and Pride were the same, but K1 was their strictly kickboxing, and then Pride was the MMA thing, but they like early mid 90s to early late 90s, and then early parts of the 2000s. There was some really wacky stuff that would go on with Japanese MMA. Like I remember Kron talking about how, like as a little boy, he would remember being in Japan with his father, and he'd have to get up in the middle of the night and go down to the academy, and his dad would have to fight people, like fight for honor. Like he's like, there's some fighter who questions your legitimacy and Hickson would like gather up his kids and be like, Daddy's got to go take care of it, and they'd go in. No press allowed, and they go in the dough, and Kron and Hickson would fuck them up, and they come out and be like, sorry, I challenge you. And there's some weird,
Holy shit,
frontier honor, you know, like they don't, it's so strange. Can you imagine being a little kid and your dad having to go, like in the middle of the night, just like, sorry, I have to go fist fight a dude.
I can't imagine. My dad almost got into one fight one time, and it was at a batting range because the ball kept hitting me, and the two stone kids in the back were laughing, because I just... and I'd be like, and they'd laugh, and my dad's like, it's not fucking funny. It isn't funny, but it is funny.
From like a father's point of view.
From a father's point of view, no. But if you have no connection to kids, and you're some kid working, and
how
you're watching
you?
This, maybe like 10.
Oh, that's not funny. If you were 14, it'd be hysterical. I don't know if I'd be laughing if like a little, like a 9-10-year-old kid is like getting plunked with
balls. I was getting fucking hammered.
Like, oh, dude, are you all right?
I got hit in the head and got knocked on the ground. It was like, but it was
high school kid. That's hysterical.
I can imagine that. All I can imagine is the whole time I kept going, what If He Was Murdered, the Gracies are the kind of fan. What a great fucking movie. It's like that movie Next to Kin with Patrick Swayze and Liam Neeson. It's like,
and they don't even need to talk about it. It's just like, look, we're going to get him.
Even the ones that don't even speak anymore would all be like, all right, everyone, let's go. It's just fucking fast. And I guarantee you, what a fucking wrong family to piss off.
Well, and Hickson's older brother died as well. Holds Gracie.
Really?
Who was supposed, like, they all, everyone kind of gives Hickson the credit for being the greatest Gracie as far as fighting. But they say that if Holds didn't pass away, he would have been the greatest of all the greats.
And Hickson only doesn't have as much recognition as Hoist because Hoist was in America fighting for the UFC through Horion.
Yep. Horion and then his sons, Henner. Now, Henner and I forgot his other his brother's name, but they've really kept that
Hacksaw.
Family.
Hacksaw.
Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Yeah. But they have the Gracie Academies that they've opened. And they've been on Loveland, too, and just – the way that they can impart the message behind jiu-jitsu to, like, the layman is beautiful. Like, as Henner and Horion especially, they're such good spokespeople for the sport.
That's
for
so
art.
Crazy. Yeah. What – I don't even know how we got talking about jiu-jitsu.
Well, we were talking about fighting and how we don't want to. But I said I love it in the sense that I like to challenge myself in that way, like the feeling of a fight. But I would never want to engage in, like, fighting on the street, you know?
Yeah, like combat.
Yeah. But now that I'm a father – like, I feel more prone to doing it. I definitely do.
Oh, yeah.
I get really angry at people now. When I see people cussing in public or littering, like, really? It used to be like, what a scumbag. Now I'm like, I just want to strangle them, you know? Because really? I feel like I'm the protector of this whole world now for my children, you know?
That's interesting.
I know. It's weird. And it's so barbaric and not cool, but I definitely feel that way.
How did you meet your wife?
On Loveline. She was a guest on Loveline.
Are you serious?
Yeah. She did a movie with Danny McBride and Nick Swartzen called 30 Minutes or Less.
Oh, I saw 30 Minutes or Less.
Yeah, yeah. She was the stripper. She played the stripper named Juicy.
Oh, shut up.
Yeah.
That was a great fucking movie.
It was a very funny movie, yeah.
I've known Nick for like probably 15 years.
He's the best.
Yeah, he's the best. He's fucking fascinating. But Danny McBride, I think, just is fucking genius.
Yeah. I don't think he gets enough credit for being as funny and smart as he really is.
Yeah. I mean, I still will play scenes from Eastbound and Down in my head and laugh out loud.
Well,
just the scene.
I give him credit for saying the funniest thing ever on television. And that was he was giving a speech to his new Mexican teammates. And Kenny Powers said, "There's no I in the word team, but there is a you in cunt, and you guys are being fucking cunts right now." I was hitting my couch, like, alone watching that.
There's no I in the word team, but there's a you in cunt. You guys are being cunts right now. Oh, what a great fucking... Oh.
Yeah, so she came in to promote that movie, and that's how we met.
Really?
Yeah.
And did you... What's the proper way, if you had to say, like, do you think...
Mm-hmm.
I wonder this sometimes now, but there's a good, like, you went in meeting her with a little bit of an edge. Like, she was
on my turf.
Yeah, yeah. You had a game plan, and you do you think you could have gotten your wife had you just been in a band, never got on radio, and were still working it as a band?
No, and even though my wife now has said that, you know, she was really enamored by me, not, you know, physically is one thing, but she said, as I talked to her more and more during the show on and off the air, she really, like, was drawn to me. There's no way that I would have ever approached her had I not been forced to talk to her for 2 hours by her being a guest on my radio show.
Yeah.
Even though we met on the radio show, it took 7 months of her painting me into a corner before I even asked her out.
Really?
Yeah, we met in fall. It wasn't until the end of summer that I actually asked her out, you know, because she would tweet me, she would direct message me. Then she finally got my number, then she started texting me. She's like, "How about this? This is my number, you can text me." And then, like, dropping it. And finally she's like, "Are you going to ask me out or what?" And
oh my God, that's what my wife said.
Yeah.
She said, "If you ask me out, you know I'll go."
Yeah.
And I was like, "You want to go out with me?"
And I'm such a puss that I go, "Okay, well, what should I ask?" That was my response. Like, not, "Yeah, will you go out with me?" I was like, "Should I ask you to dinner or something? Or do you want to just..." She's like, you're a mess. I really am. I'm not at all smooth or anything.
That's crazy.
I just never would have assumed, and I've said this on the air, you know, 1,000 times, but it's the truth. It's like, look, we have a lot of really hot actresses and models that come on the show. It's great. I get to meet them, and I seem to get along with a lot of them. But never in a million years do I assume that they want anything to do with me romantically.
Oh, that's so interesting. I assume the exact opposite with you. Like, you're obviously a good-looking dude.
Thank you.
Probably never had problems with women. You're in good shape. You got a perfect head of hair. You're smart as fuck.
I have nice hair, yes.
You have your hair is, like, literally... That's what I thought I'd have the rest of my life. But
Brian Callen said that if I was ever on a movie set, they'd have to thin my hair, not thick it.
Like, yeah, they may have to thin out your hair. Just because it for everyone else, it's going to look like a helmet compared to what they have.
Yeah, no. I look, that all being said, and I certainly appreciate the compliments, but there's a lot more to I think it's – that would work if I was a girl trying to get guys. Because we're so physically driven, and that's really all a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Some chicks really suck, but they're hot, and so they get a lot of guys to just bend over back. Women really are looking for so much more, and confidence being the big thing. It sounds cliche because so many women say that, but I just don't. You know, I went through my whole high school life when you're really kind of piecing together how to do it with one girlfriend, and we were very abusive to each other emotionally, not physically, but and you know, that was the girl who like let me do anything.
Is this
sexually.
The pinata?
Yeah. And she was down for whatever, but we were also very abusive to each other in separate ways. And then I you know, for my early 20s, I was way high and drunk every day. And I never associated with any girls. I never asked a girl out on a date in my life.
Yeah.
I would occasionally be partying with chicks and we'd end up having sex. You know, I if you call that success with women, so be it. You know, I was lucky enough to do that, but I never like had, I never ever got to the point where I felt confident enough to deal with the sweaty palms, walk up to a girl I saw at like a supermarket, bar, club, whatever it may be, and be like, oh, you know, are you single? You want to go out sometime? I never did it. I never believed in myself. And I still to this day, earlier in the podcast, you asked, when did you know when you felt like you were really a man? And I said it was recently, and I meant that sincerely, and it was because I started to finally have a realistic self-image. You know, I always had such a negative self-image of myself, I still, you know, I still deal with it, but now I've finally been able to kind of honestly and earnestly say, like, I like these things about myself, and I believe that I could be a good dad or good at my job, or, you know, and I never could do that until, you know, maybe a year ago or so. So that's when I knew I could be, like, a real man. I could wrap my head around my limitations and my positives and really kind of be comfortable in them. But my wife, you know, I would have never in a million years thought to like, oh, yeah, well, just ask her out, see what she's doing. You know, and so, but till she made it completely easy for me. And then once we started dating, it was obvious to me, like, she was the one.
She was one?
Yeah.
What, what was your average over under on having sex with chicks? Like, first date?
For the most part,
yeah. Yeah.
Like, but again, all dates I ever went on were like happenstance. It was either my friend hooked me up with a girl, and so she'd be like, you should go out. We'll go out together, and I'll bring her along.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's like, Thursday night, I'm going to see fucking Kaiser Chiefs. You want to come with me? That stuff started to happen after the divorce.
Wait, you never told them. I don't think you ever told them how the divorce went down.
I went to a birthday party in Vegas, and I drove back to L.A. early. To just spend the rest of the weekend with my wife, and I got there and there was like a moving van and a couple of her female friends.
Holy
and she's like,
shit, do you lose your shit when that happens?
No, it's not one of those things where it's like, oh my God, it was almost like, it was, I guess you could call it shock because I couldn't, like my brain didn't register, you know?
So you more like were just like confused.
Yeah.
Kind of like when like someone breaks into your house. And you're just like, hey, what are you doing in my house? You're not allowed to be in my house.
I'm in my house. You're in my house. How does that – the same thing. It was like, oh, wait, so you're leaving. And she's like, no, I just need to move out. We need to separate. And she was – you know, she was very – it wasn't like she was mean to me. She was just like – and like she said to me when it happened, if you couldn't – how could you not have seen the writing on the wall? And I for years was like, there was the writing on the wall. You're full of shit. And now being able to look back on it, like, of course there was. It wasn't like I was
– pamphlets from U-Haul. And
yeah. I mean it wasn't like I was a connected, really present guy and husband, and nor was she. You know, I'm not going to put all the blame on me, but, you know, it's not like she was a committed, great wife and supportive person, because I'm a sick guy, and I was even sicker then. I needed support. I needed help. I was so depressed.
Really?
So
were you not on medication at the time?
Mm-mm.
Really?
Mm-mm.
Shit. I wonder what percentage of people are like clinically depressed.
Yeah.
I imagine it's so much higher.
I wonder what percentage of people that aren't medicated or aren't seeking treatment of some sort are clinically depressed. I also wonder how many people that say they are and are getting medication aren't. They're just not really willing to do the other stuff.
I get depressed on the road. And what my new motive is, my new motif is the second I wake up, I have to get out of the bed and go take a shower. Because if I lay in bed, the crazy thoughts start coming. They just start whispering.
Idle hands, man. Idle hands, especially for creative people. Idle hands is the worst thing ever. Because then you just get you start to get introverted as opposed to introspective. You know, I'm assuming for a comic, being introspective is the best thing in the world.
Oh, that's yeah.
It's essential. But when you start to just get needlessly introverted, where you just you exist, you bank around these kind of hollow thoughts within yourself, it's just terrible, you know?
Oh, it's frightening, because you just sit there and you start thinking, oh, Tony Gwynn died of mouth cancer. Oh, I wonder how he knew it was coming. I wonder if it's anything like this thing in my mouth. And then all of a sudden I'm fucking in a hurt locker. It's like you said the thing about Adam Lambert, and you wondered if that was the thing that got you fired, and you get this media storm. I one time was on a show on Spike called Fresh Baked Video Games. I went to do press, and I knew the show was getting canceled. I mean, it was like the writing was on the wall.
Right.
And I knew it was going to happen, and I was in the interview doing press for the improv. And they're like, so tell us about Fresh Baked Video Games. And I was so obsessed with being real that I was like, it's not that good. And they're like, really? I said, I mean, it could be good, but no one's watching it. The numbers are low, so it's probably going to get canceled.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay. And like the guy literally had nothing to say to me.
Sure.
And it was like almost I stumped him. And I was like, well, I could sit here and say it's an amazing show, but you'll never watch it. And none of the people we're making for are going to watch it, because they are playing video games and not watching TV.
Right. Yeah, they're playing awesome-ass video games.
Yeah, and the guy was like, oh, I guess you don't want to work, huh? And I was like, I didn't. And I drove back to Clearwater, and I said, what the fuck did you do?
Right.
I mean, it's a valuable learning lesson. It's a valuable lesson to learn in this business, is always be gracious. Always, you got to always love that someone has paid you to do anything.
Sure, exactly. And look, I mean, everyone has the desire to. I mean, I want to be Howard Stern, and everyone wants to be Lenny Bruce, or you know, one of these people who really told it like it, wasn't afraid to. But at the same time, you also have to be so happy that someone's paying you to do something.
Yeah.
And there's a certain, I think, level of respect that comes with being an employee, and that's at the end of the day, you're still just an employee. Now, it's very weird, though, as a performer, in any capacity, though, because the line gets blurred between showing respect for your employer and then allowing your employer to abuse you. Because sometimes people can abuse you, and then I think you're obligated to be like, fuck this, you know? And I have a very powerful forum having a radio show, you know, luckily, I've known people in the radio business, very talented people, who just get abused, you know? But
really?
I've worked for great people all my whole. K Rock in and of itself is just like, it's an excellent, excellent.
How long
place.
Have you been at K Rock?
Since 2002.
Shut up. That's a long time to be one place.
Yep. Yeah. And then not banking around. I was on the Kevin and Bean Show, and then I was on the Kevin and Bean Show and Loveline, and now I'm just on Loveline. So I went from their marquee morning show to hosting the marquee evening show, yeah.
That's great.
It's truly still surreal to me, even after, you know, 12 years or whatever.
That really is surreal. Yeah. I mean, I
prank call Loveline all the time.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, so to think about, like, what that means to, you know, I used to, like, just really worship at the altar of Jimmy and Adam, you know, and Adam. What Adam would do.
Adam on Loveline was the funniest fucking human being I've ever heard in my entire life.
You could take any two breaks and put it into a half-hour set, and it would be as good of a stand-up comedy set as anyone had ever done. You know, that's how amazing he was.
My buddy Lorenzo is obsessed with Adam Carolla. And when I first moved out here, I moved in with my buddy Lorenzo, and he was a photographer, and this is back when they used film, and he'd have to go drop off his proofs. Mm-hmm. And he loved dropping off his proofs, and I was like, why? And he's like, I get to listen to Loveline. So he'd time off dropping off his proofs to, so that he'd listen to Loveline, and he used to make me – he'd go, why don't you come with me, man? You'll really enjoy it. And I just – you know, it's like Florida was a weird radio place. You had – like a couple
really competitive
but yeah. But like a couple morning shows, you never had anything evening. Like,
yeah,
you, like there was no,
well,
evening.
That, dude, that's not just Florida, that's radio. I mean, yeah. Loveline is a truly unique entity for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that it's a show that's really working hard to get ratings at 10 11 12 o'clock at night, because yeah. for most radio stations, even talk radio stations, it's considered a dumping ground. And I'm not saying that everyone that's on the radio at that time is not worthy of being on the radio or not good, because I obviously don't listen to a lot, but you know, it's rare. I know, talking to PDs and stuff, you don't really go out of your way to try to do like new and fresh programming overnights anymore. Yeah. It's just not something you do. So yeah, it's really kind of crazy. But Florida, man, Florida really is like a unique radio area.
Yeah, it's
Florida's dudes get furious over there with each other. They don't fuck around.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of goodwill in LA with radio personalities.
Really?
Yeah, we all get along. I mean, it's certainly from my point of view. I've never had any negative experience with any other radio personality here in Los Angeles.
So you were doing K-Rock when Adam was doing Loveline.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fucking crazy. Yeah. Yeah, he was just so quick and so fucking smart and so witty and so, like, you know, it's a good, I gotta be honest with you, I mean, I'm not shitting on anyone that's had the job before you, mm-hmm. but you're a much better fit than it was before you. Does that make sense?
Thank you. And I look, at least if I feel like I
it
have
it feels like a partnership as opposed to a radio show.
Yeah.
Which was Adam and Dr. Drew were like a partnership.
They still are.
They still are, obviously.
They still are. I mean, when they go on stage to do their live shows, they still do a podcast now. You know, they're like an old married couple that likes to show off in front of their friends and talk shit to each other, but they finish each other's sentences and they totally know like how to get the
really
best out of each other.
Fucking crazy. You
know? Yeah.
That's I mean, it really is surreal to think, you know. But I when I did Loveline, I had a fucking blast. And
yeah, you got to come back soon, man.
I'd love to.
Whenever
I'd
you're
love
in town
to.
For like a good amount of time, it seems
yeah,
like
you're... I'd love it. I had such a great time doing it. Now, what's like I can't imagine that someone like you doesn't have like a 10-year plan.
I want to be a television personality, but not, you know, like I said, I worship at the altar of like Jimmy and Adam. And it's not just because they're great at what they do, but, you know, I really felt like there was something so special about the fact that, like, hey, man, you know, like how a lot of guys talk about, like, well, that guy's from my neighborhood. And it gave me hope that I could do something. Like, Jimmy and Adam were on the morning show at K-Rock working yeah. with Kevin and Bean. And they have – Kevin and Bean have stories about – remember that time when Adam and Jimmy came in and he blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, man, I want to be like them. And I in no way think I could host a late-night show as well as Jimmy does. But that is the if I wish upon a star, that would be what I do, is be like a late night guy.
Yeah.
I like to have conversations. I like to do it, and I like to do it to the point that people who are on the receiving end of it enjoy it, but also people who like maybe get a chance to watch or listen in do.
Yeah.
That's what I've always wanted to do, you know?
Yeah, they really did kind of burn a path that I think all of us look at and go, well, that I'd love to be the head of the helm of my own pirate ship.
Yeah.
I'd love to be fucking, I mean, they also have been partners. Like, they're like, that kind of blew me away that they're still working together. Like, that they have that Jackhole Productions is them.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'd love to be able to sell numerous shows to networks and just be the brand with the stamp of approval.
It's true.
For young male audiences, but you got to earn it.
I want to create too, though. I mean, that's the big thing for me. Like, right now, I'm just starting to scratch the surface of really being able to write stuff and create TV, and I'm getting my first real crack at it right now. And
what are you doing?
I'm working on an animated show based on a character that I'd been doing on the radio for a long time.
Oh yeah,
and
is it the one you did with me?
Possibly.
Yeah.
yeah, I don't know how much I'm. You know,
I don't know
aspects of it, but you know, and getting like the inside. And this is my first. I've attempted to create TV before and gotten a little bites, but this is my first real success where someone's picked up the show and like we're taking it to production. And so that's what I'd really love to do, ideally, is be able to have a radio show or TV show, whatever it is, where I could do my thing, my, you know, kind of play to my skill set, but also be able to produce and write and you know, create these funny characters and stuff. I love that aspect of it. That's Kid in the Candy Store for me, is like to be able to think of like these weird worlds where characters exist and yeah. funny situations for them to.
I wish I just had a fucking production company where I could just come up with an idea, someone would write it out, we could get it to my agent, we could send it out on pitches and set up pitches.
Like, I think that's what's so beautiful about Dick House and like Johnny Knoxville and those guys, is that it's almost like that. It's like, what would happen if like a 12-year-old guy got a production company, is that Knoxville or Bam or Spike Jones, yeah. like they have a weird idea and they just make it. It just yeah. happens. You know, they're like, I'm gonna douche Bam's ass with a soda can. Dunk, dunk. Yeah. And then it's live and ready to go, you know?
I need seed money. I need like $100,000 to get an office, get a bullpen, get a bunch of young writers, come in. They're there all week. I come yeah. in when I'm in town and I'm like, all right, guys, here are my ideas. I want to be shooting this in 1 week.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I need to do.
I always feel too, and I'm a total amateur. I don't really know, but I feel like with podcasting and with the internet and with digital cameras being what they are now, I mean, you're capable of making such amazing video so easily now.
Yeah.
I feel like it's never been easier to do what you're talking about, but at the same time, it's probably never been harder because there's 500 channels and everyone's putting TV on now.
Well, it becomes this, I mean, it gets so fucking complicated just with like, I mean, like I came up with a show idea and then I pitched it and then it's like, it gets sticky. Like, who wants to produce it? And you're just like, oh.
You want to know the beauty about what I think with stand-up and with radio as well?
What's that?
Is that the true beauty of it. It's like every stand-up, I'm sure, would love to be a star of a sitcom.
But, oh, yeah.
But most of them, whether it's Jerry Seinfeld or Ray Romano, they still continue to do stand-up. They always go back to it because there's a certain connection and immediacy to it that you can't get with any amount of TV.
Oh, yeah.
TV, there's always, whether you're on the back of this cable channel or you're on ABC, there's too many cooks in the kitchen. From the germ of an idea to the production of a show, 85 people have to sign off on stuff and get their grimy hands all over it. You want to go up on stage and tell a joke? Boom.
Done.
I go on the air tonight and I want to talk about being on Bert Kreischer's podcast. End of story.
Done.
I go. And like, people hear my
life. I'm going to post this tonight.
Please do. Yeah.
I'm going to fucking post this tonight. I'm doing nothing.
Let me know whenever you do so I can
talk about it. I'm going to post it tonight.
I'll tweet about it and stuff.
Yeah, I'll post it tonight because, I mean, it's like such a seamless conversation. I'm thinking about cutting out my intro and my outro and just posting straight up audio files. Yeah. Like, I'm like, fuck the production side of it. It just makes things more difficult for me.
Yeah, I mean, it is. That is the beauty of a podcast, is that there's no one to tell you not to do that.
Oh, you know, it's the greatest. Yeah. It's what's, you know, it's so funny though about what you just said about this business and about all the cooks in the kitchen, is that you get a podcast, then you get like a top 50 podcast, mm-hmm. and your podcast is flirting in the top 25 every now and then, and then all these cooks show up, and they're like, well, let's sit you down with this guy. We want to meet. Well, you should meet with this guy. This guy knows what he's doing. Let's monetize your podcast. I've never monetized it, so I'm just like, and I'm sure I'm leaving money on the table. But right. I just personally, I'm like, hey, if you like this podcast, go check out the shit that Mike has, and go check out the shit that I have,
yeah.
and then just like us.
I don't know if you are leaving money on the table though, because I think, and this is speculation, I do work for a company that makes a lot of podcasts and does monetize in it, and it does seem like, unless you're Mark Maron, Joe Rogan, or Adam, you're not gonna make. You know,
I think you're making.
I mean, I think that, like, I think that the people that are, you know, like I said, the big guys, the Kevin Smith and the Joe Rogans and Adam Carolla, Mark Maron, you're making some money, but yeah. I don't think there's any middle ground. I think you're either.
Bill Burr's making a dickload of money.
Is he? Yeah.
Bill Burr's making a. I mean, I shouldn't say that. Not Bill hasn't told me he's making a dickload of money. Rumor on the street is Bill Burr's making a dickload of money. Yeah.
He's
and
a
I
good
know,
dude too, man.
He's amazing.
He's a good dude.
He's fucking.
I don't know him that well, but just we've had him on the show a couple times.
He's
and
so smart.
Like you would assume because of kind of like the Boston thing and like that he's tough talking. Like, oh man, I hope this guy's not a prick because you could easily assume he would be.
Yeah,
and he's such a nice guy. He's
the nicest fucking guy. Like if I showed you his text to me, like how my book came out and I wanted to promote it, and Bill's like, why don't you come on my podcast and promote it? And I was like, I'd love to. Obviously, his podcast is one of the fucking top five podcasts. Yeah. So I text him, and he's like, I mean, this is Bill. He's like, man, I'm having stuff going on in my house to redo in my house. Bill's, by the way, very private, so I'm sure he's not wanting me to share any of this. But like, he's like, can I come to your house tonight? We'll do it, and then I'll release it tomorrow. Or maybe we can do one. And he's like trying to think of everything around it. And I go, Bill, don't worry about it. Like, you're my friend first. Don't worry about your getting me on your fucking podcast. Yeah. Like, we'll figure it out. And Bill's like, really? Thanks, man.
That's the sign of a guy who's really earned his stripes, though. You know, yeah. Like, that's why I think I love stand-up so much and have such a high respect for him, because the overnight success has been at it for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, like, people are like, well, that guy just came on scene. It's like, no, he's been working the clubs for 11 years.
Yeah,
it's
I've been doing stand-up 15 fucking years. Exactly. Like, I know the guys who do it professionally.
Yeah.
I know them personally. They are my friends. And when we go and we have a beer, we talk shop, we talk bullshit, we talk about who's doing what and what this guy's an asshole and did you hear this story? It's like,
I feel like you have to earn your stripes to be a good stand-up. And with kind of the YouTube generation, I feel like a lot of that's lost. You know, people assume like there's got to be a means to an end, but they don't understand what the means are. You know, and I'm not talking shit. It's just, it's so easy to assume like, well, look, I can get a million followers on Twitter, I'm going to be a celebrity. I'm going to put up YouTube videos, I'm going to be a celebrity. And it's like, no, man, there's a lot of guys who used to do open mic nights for drink money. There's a lot of guys who used to work the door at the Improv just so they could hope that they could open up for an established person, you know, and they've been doing it for 10 years. Like, that's what I think I love. He's like, and same with like American Idol and all this, what it does for musicians. I really think there was some beauty in getting in the van and having to go out there and not have eating Pop-Tarts for dinner for 9 years until you could finally get your song on the radio and stuff.
It's the thing I miss. This is going to sound shitty and cunty, and I'm sorry everybody already. I miss the nobility of someone saying, I want to be an entertainer.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat fed up by the I'm trying to think of
Celebutantes.
And it's
people
like,
who are famous essentially just for having the name that they have. Yeah.
Or that distinctly, or the people who like go about it the roundabout way. Like, I saw this thing and I shit on them a little bit, but I don't shit on them. But like, sometimes you'll see guys that have reality shows where it's like, we're the I'm gonna use an example that was on Travel Channel because they're my family and I feel like I'm not gonna go. I'm gonna keep it in the family. This is a show that was on a very long time ago, but like, or let me, you know what? Scrap Travel. This is very easy. The guy that's a marlin fisher.
Okay,
that's got like the deadliest marlin fishing boat. But you realize very quickly he just wants to be fucking famous.
Right.
He doesn't give a fuck about his fishing boat. The fishing boat's a scam, a cover, a beard for his want to be fame.
Right.
Famous. And it's like, I miss the nobility of the Jerry Seinfeld that said, I'm in this to be famous.
Right.
I'm in this because I want to be an entertainer and I want to make people, and it's a very shallow fucking want, but like, own it. Don't say you're a fucking cake maker.
Right.
But you really just want to be fucking famous. No, I'm not shitting on Sonny, the cake boss, but like,
I mean, there's a lot of very entertaining, charismatic people who do these like wild jobs that they film and they make it. But you're right. I mean, some people wanted to be musicians. Some people want to be comics. Some people want to be actors. It's like, that's it. That's how you are a performer. And it's never been brought to my eyes with so much clarity as it has of late, because everyone that gets like big jobs in television hosting is a former model or was a Spice Girl or was an actor. And it's like, no, you understand there is a job called host and there's a seal to it.
And there's a muscle.
Yeah. And I'm not in radio so that I can parlay that into getting my band signed. Or like,
yeah,
I want to be a host. I got into this because I wanted to be Howard Stern or Johnny Carson or Jimmy Kimmel. And that's what I want to do. I'm not going to parlay it off into 9 different things. I
want to
host.
And there's a nobility to knowing what you want.
Yeah.
And saying it out there. Like, I tell you what, I love hosting. I'll never stop hosting as long as I live. It is a muscle that I've figured out, and I can do it, and it's fun as fuck, and it's not a stretch. Like, I know me. So I know me, and I know what to say and what not to say. But I also want a sitcom.
Right.
Like, my
Do you want to come on to one with other people, or would you love to write
mine?
One?
I don't want to be like third person on it, only because I'm not that good of an actor. So like your wife could probably fucking pull it off. I'm not. I can play me. That's the host part of me.
Yeah.
Like, I know me, and I can be me, like, pretty good. But if you're like, Burp, can you be the wacky neighbor who lives in his mom's basement and plays bass? I'm like, I don't know that guy.
Yeah.
Because I'm not that fucking guy. I've never been that guy. I don't know how he – what does he say when things – like, I was never good at auditions.
Yeah.
Like, they'd give me sides, and I'd be like – I mean, I remember one time I was leaning up against a wall in audition. Like, that's how bad I was.
What? Maybe you were playing a greaser.
No. I was fucking just bad. And so I'm
leaning
fucking,
up
like,
against the wall.
Yeah, I was like, oh. And so, but like, I want to host. I want to do,
yeah.
I want to do, I wouldn't mind doing more of what I'm doing with travel or in another capacity. I mean, I'd done some pilots with Comedy Central that didn't go anywhere, but they were all fun as fuck to do.
Yeah. I think that, look, there has to be a return because right now things are just too oversaturated. I always compare it to pitching in Major League Baseball. After, like, in the mid-90s with expansion teams and everything, it just – there was just too much. There was,
yeah.
And so the pitching got diluted and people started hitting bombs and steroids, whatever. But there was a return to, like, really ratcheting it down. And after all these cable shows and all these crazy like, let's follow around a guy who opens storage lockers and that's a show.
That's it. That's what I'm talking – yeah, yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There has to – eventually there's going to be a sea change and people are going to want to watch professionals do – make TV.
Yeah. By the way, the show I was talking about on Travel Channel, just so people don't speculate about my friends or possible friends, it was a show about a moving company.
Yeah.
And they're a very popular moving company, and that is their business. But it was like you could tell that they were hiring like actors, it got canceled very quickly. And I'm not shitting on any insight that Travel ever had about, but all those people that hired it are gone.
Yeah.
It's like I don't know, whatever happened to the guy that just wanted to have a moving company? Like, doesn't that guy exist? Can't you just want to have a moving company?
Oh, for sure. But, you know, can't you be a plumber
without wanting to be famous?
You almost can't blame certain people because there's the people who they actually don't have a job. It's a fictitious job that they create for the TV show. But
yes.
Then there's the people who just are like the Pawn Stars guys. They were funny dudes that owned a pawn shop. And someone at Left Field Productions is like, we got to film this, you know?
Yeah.
So there's the two sides of the – like those guys, you're like, I can't blame them. You know,
yeah.
or the cake boss guy is like, wacky cakes. You know? Like,
yeah, he's into cakes. Sonny is his name. And he's a nice guy.
Someone eventually saw that and was like, that's pretty awesome. We should film it, you know? But then there's the people – you're totally right. They're like, none of the storage lockers on Auction Hunters and Storage Wars are real storage lockers that people are bidding on. You understand that, people? It's a part of a TV set.
I mean,
yeah.
Production-wise, do you realize how fucking difficult that would be to open a locker for real and have no brands, no fucking porn, no dead... I mean, that's impossible.
Yeah.
And they've got fucking lighting. It's lit.
If you want reality where they just go into stuff and they don't know what's going to be on the other side of it, watch Hoarders. That's real.
Yeah.
They find cat carcass... And poop, that's real. You know, that's what you'd find if the Storage Wars was legit, you know? Like,
yeah, I get frustrated when I see production, like, over the top. Like, there's something about restaurants. I don't know. It's not on food and it's not on cooking. It's on some other channel.
Like Bar Rescue?
Yeah, something Bar Rescue. But it's like, one of the things, I'm watching it, and these people are sitting at the bar, and they got, like, the overhead camera, and they're sitting at the bar by themselves, and it's, like, black and white, like, sketchy, and they're like, where's our bartender? How come our bartender isn't here?
We haven't had service in 9 minutes.
9 minutes, and then they're sitting there, and they're having a conversation. I can't believe we haven't had a bartender. I'm like, I can't believe we have audio on this.
Yeah.
Like, who's mic'd? Who's got a fucking mic on that I can hear this conversation?
Yeah.
Someone's got to have... I've been on TV long enough to know that my lapel isn't picking up their conversation. You can't just put one over by the bar and hope it's going to pick it up. Someone's wearing a fucking mic.
Yeah.
And so I get frustrated.
But again, I think that that's going to trickle down to not just people who are frustrated with it that work in TV. Eventually, everyone's going to be like, okay, I just want to watch a talk show where you have guests and a band. Like, I want to watch a TV show where a host presents me stuff. You know, like, I'm done watching a guy crab fish.
I've been really excited at what is theoretically these late night wars with Kimmel, Fallon, Seth Green,
Seth Meyers,
Letterman, fucking Conan, like five dudes going at it.
Yeah.
I love it. And I got to be honest with you. I mean, Kimmel's always going to be Kimmel. It's not like he's going to. He brought a group of people that had never gone to late night into late night. He set his own fucking – he's got his own supply and demand.
The two Jimmys are the future. They really are. They're,
Jimmy Fallon is fucking good.
Yeah, but they understand it. They understand, like, attention span now and real modern comedy. They get the two Jimmys are the future. But I'm actually a little bit hurt and, like, not hurt. I'm just sad that David Letterman's going because he's our last nexus to the real to the Carson era, to the Steve Allen era of the traditional talk show. He's our last connection.
He I tweeted this the other night. He interviewed Paris Hilton right after she got out of jail. She was promoting a perfume.
It's the best.
It is the best interview I've ever fucking
that
seen.
Or how about his Spencer Pratt interview when Spencer was at like the height of like his popularity?
Nope.
Dave's like, oh, yeah. So you're kind of like you're a dope, huh? It just starts it off.
By the way, I'm emailing this to myself right now because I want to fucking watch that. Let's see. Spencer Pratt.
Oh shit! It's 8 o'clock.
Okay, all right.
I gotta go to work.
I'm gonna post this now about hour 19. Mike, thank you very much.
Dude, you're the man.
Thank you. This has been a fucking blast.
Anytime,
man.
Mr. Christ.
All right, I will talk to you soon then.
All right,
bye. This episode was brought to you by The Machine.